Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a quick look at the front pages before we meet our panel. So the Sunday Independent is leading with checks at border as migrant controls ramped up. So there's a thing called Operation Sonnet, which is a joint policing initiative between the Garda National Immigration Bureau and the PSNI. And they held 3 days of action on the main Belfast to Dublin road last week. And Maeve Sheehan was there and takes us through all the process, stopping buses, taking people off and putting them on ferries, etc. There's also an off-lead there in the Sunday Independent. Harris Martin families are targeted by pro-Israel site. The Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been made aware of a troubling US-based social media account which is targeting members of their families. The Sunday Times, there are a few pictures of dejected poor Leinster players on front pages today, and they have a picture of the coach Leo Cullen consoling Kieran Frawley and Luke McGrath looking on, and they all look just so gutted. Their third year in a row losing in the Champions Cup final. They also have Martin, we do not want to cut ties with Israel. So the Taoiseach just saying that he has no issue with the Israeli ambassador returning to a role in Ireland. And they also mention in that piece that Twitter X account from a US-based organisation, Stop Anti-Semitism. The Business Post has a political poll, which we will come back to. The Irish Mail on Sunday. So their front page, they are bringing the GAA Go scandal together with the GAA Go row together with the RTE funding crisis, will we use that word? And they say influential cabinet ministers are saying GAA Go must go if RTE get 50 million bailout. It does say, however, in one of those kind of unnamed ministers says it'll be the next government enacting the future of RTE. The Sunday World is leading with the funeral of Josh Itzaley, and they are saying pastor begs pals of gun victim Josh Itzaley to stay away from gang violence as he live streams funeral for distraught family. The Mirror and the Sun are both leading what will be for many people the big news this weekend. TV royalty Eamon Holmes and Ruth Langford are divorcing after 14 years of marriage. The Sun's front page is no way back. They say, the source says here, their work commitments took them in different directions. Okay. Our panel today, Louise Byrne is political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Oisin Coughlan is chief executive for Friends of the Earth Ireland. Bobby McDonough is former ambassador to the UK and the EU. And Larissa Nolan is features editor at the Reach Group of newspapers and websites. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Louise Byrne, can you tell us about this Twitter account that's on the front of the Sunday Independent and the Sunday Times today?
Yeah, so this, I guess, comes in the wake of Ireland announcing that it was going to officially recognise the state of Palestine. And it was announced on Wednesday. It officially takes place on this Tuesday coming. And I guess there has kind of been Israeli pushback. You saw that before the announcement was even made, that there was Israeli pushback to the Irish government's announcement. And I think what it's culminated in the last couple of days is quite distressing Twitter posts, posts on X or Twitter, which are just blatantly misinformation and disinformation and are quite disturbing. So I saw them myself yesterday or the day before, and essentially it's pictures of Taoiseach Simon Harris with his daughter, pictures of Taoiseach Micheál Martin with his family, and it makes false claims about their daughters. I don't really want to spread misinformation on the radio, but completely and utterly nonsense referencing Hamas, and just really, really disturbing content that you would kind of question why anyone in their right mind would actually put it out in the first place. So I think both in the Sunday Independent and in the Sunday Times, the Taoiseach are actually having a go in the Sunday Times about the fact that X or Twitter wouldn't take down this post. He said it's completely unacceptable and it's time that legislators tackle these issues. His office in Fianna Fáil reported it to X. They didn't take it down and they heard back. The Taoiseach's office has also apparently reported and they haven't heard anything back. But I guess it kind of... brings together two real issues, really. The issue of misinformation, disinformation on sites like X, where there just seems to be absolutely no responsibility or no onus on X and its owners to take down really disturbing misinformation that's completely just off the walls. And I guess then at the same time, it brings in the other issue of Ireland's recognition of Palestine, what that means for the government's relationship with Israel. And it's a really interesting story, and I don't think anyone would have seen this coming.
Okay. Oisin, you were looking at that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows how toxic online debate has become, and also how it's instrumentalized in geopolitics now. And we know this from, you know, efforts that intervened in elections, but and the personal abuse involved. I think the answer on the tech side is probably that we need to regulate big tech better, and probably start treating social media platforms as publishers so that they're held liable for defamation. And I know that's not like been resisted in places like the US, but I don't know whether Ireland could do that on its own with any great effect. But it's certainly, I think, something that should be on the table. And obviously, it in this case, it's about Ireland's, you know, diplomatic move this week to recognise the state of Palestine, which is, I think, something, as Gary Murphy's article says, we should be proud of, even if the practical impact is going to be pretty limited. And I'm guessing we might come back to that.
So, Bobby, the broader issue here, I suppose, is that this is not a neutral move to make, and there is pushback and blowback.
No, it's not a neutral move, but Ireland has tried to be even-handed. And I see there's a story today that Micheál Martin has said he'd welcome the Israeli ambassador back to Dublin. I mean, we didn't expel her. The Israelis decided to withdraw her. I mean, I think this...
Did they withdraw her, or did they temporarily come back to talk to the foreign minister?
They temporarily withdrew her.
Okay. Yeah. So would that be a withdrawal, or is it just... would an ambassador called back to base for consultations?
Recalled is the word that is used. Yeah. So for consultations. So yeah. That means that they leave open the possibility of her coming back. But I think this, just on this Twitter
account...
Just
to explain it to us. So that's not a kind of a normal quotidian thing that we're just calling her back to have a chat with her about things. It is a move, is it?
It is a move, but yeah. it's not breaking diplomatic relations. Yeah. But it's not simply her going home for a brief visit or holiday.
Okay,
It happens from time to time. But I think, you know, the Twitter account is obviously, the X account is disgraceful, and their refusal to take it down is disgraceful. But the profound irrationality that lies behind it is similar to the way the Israeli government is behaving at the moment, because their treatment of the Irish ambassador, along with her Spanish and Norwegian colleagues, where they called them in to show them film of the Hamas massacres, was utterly improper and abusive. Ambassadors are a channel of communication. They're a conduit. And so if they have messages, they're passed quietly through ambassadors to the capital. But this was a case where the ambassadors were brought in and shown disgraceful, I mean, I don't mean disgraceful, appalling imagery.
Of things that Hamas did to Israeli people
chain
of events.
No, it was what Hamas did was absolutely appalling.
Yeah.
But the equivalent would be to force the Israeli ambassador here or elsewhere to watch footage of babies being taken out of incubators and tens of thousands of people being killed. It is not the way you treat ambassadors. And then to bring the media in to film it and photograph it was further disgraceful.
So
it shows
normal behaviour.
The implication is, if you saw what we saw, you would react like we act in Gaza, which just is not the case. As in, the point of this is that the Israeli response is disproportionate and is so disproportionate as it's there's mounting evidence of breaches of international law. And the Irish opinion is that it's making peace further away, making security for Israel further away. And that's why Ireland's taken the move it has. So it shows it's not surprising given the sense of siege or the sense of atrocity that the Israelis have, but its irrational insularity is isolating Israel as opposed to the Irish action.
Okay, Larissa.
I just feel like it, I think we shouldn't be surprised at this at all. We've taken a very strong position at a very particular moment in time on probably the most controversial political toxic issue of the moment that I've seen in probably in years. And there was always going to be pushback like that. I think that, you know, I wondered had we kind of fully thought through all the risks and consequences and what was going to happen in the aftermath. I think it's entirely unsurprising. It's never right, that people's families should be targeted and so on. I don't think that it is surprising at all. I think this could have been completely assumed, and I think that if you were going to stand up and make these kind of political statements on a worldwide platform, you're going to have to maybe expect and deal with pushback and awful consequences, like people's families being put up on Twitter or whatever. I think that's something that we should maybe accept is part of life at the moment. And when you do take a stand like that, these kind of things will happen. I thought there was a really good piece today by David Quinn in the Sunday Independent in relation to, the element of taking this stance because it makes Simon Harris, Micheál Martin and Eamon Ryan look good, is what David Quinn is saying. And that the Israelis do take this as a tacit reward to Hamas. So I do think that if we are going to be brave enough and strong enough to take these world stances, we're going to have to deal with the consequences of that.
It's not an unusual stance. The vast majority of countries in the world and in the UN have taken
at this time, though. It's the timing. It's the timing of it.
Okay.
Of course, pushback was to be accepted, but it's the nature of the pushback that is completely unacceptable and unprecedented. And of course,
Bobby,
I mean, David Quinn takes.
Have we been fairly robust with the Israeli ambassador here as well? Would that be within the norms of media interviews where we're quite tough with them and everything? That's all within the normal lanes of what an ambassador would expect.
Yes, I think it has been. Yeah. We didn't expel her. And as I say, Micheál Martin has said that she'd be welcomed back. But, of course the Israelis will say that it's
rewarding Hamas. That's
their point of
view. But she has become a public figure. And if she's invited to an Ordesh or different things like that, or if she's present anywhere, there is public discussion on it. That's all within the norms.
There are subtleties in and around how these things are dealt with. But to call in an ambassador and to force them in front of the media.
I know, I'm not making any comparison.
So what I'm saying is that, of course, the Israelis are going to respond in that sort of way, and we can't control that any more than they can control us. But the reality is that the Irish government's action, along with Norway and Spain, is a way of countering extremism. Because if the Palestinian people have no political perspective for the future and the prospect of a two-state solution, that encourages extremism and more or less makes it inevitable.
So the argument
extremism
that they
is much more
ordered and they have to be offered some kind of legitimate future.
Exactly, and it's Netanyahu's behaviour, the disproportionate response that's encouraging Palestinian extremism, not the Irish.
And just to add one more, just before I come to you, one more question for Bobby, as this is kind of your area of expertise in terms of the Hamas welcoming the move. And, people will say, well, we can't control what Hamas will do. Is that an unfortunate byproduct of it all, though? Because the optics of it there are that the terrorist recognises the terrorist organisation is welcoming the move.
It's an unfortunate byproduct, but it is not the optic. It is one optic. And most people would regard the Irish government's action, as you say, most countries in the world, would regard it as the correct approach. We can't control how the Israelis react. We can't control how Hamas will react. But the Irish government has repeatedly condemned what happened on the 7th of October. It regards Hamas as a terrorist organisation and has supported the International Criminal Court's request for arrest warrants against leading members of Hamas. So there's absolutely no question about the Irish government's stance on Hamas. But it is inevitable, of course, that the Israelis will play up that angle.
To push back on the David Quinn article, right? This is the Irish move this week is not a response to Hamas on October the 7th. It's a response to what Israel has done since. So if Israel had launched targeted attacks, insofar as you can do that, like special forces to try to take out the leadership of Hamas, and meantime had with the US and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the Palestinian Authority convened a regional peace summit to decide what happens to move towards a two-state solution. If some Israeli government had done that, the Irish government would have said, we'll wait for that process to be finished, and as part of the resolution of that peace process, we will recognise the state of Palestine. This is, to be honest, is a sign of, like, a symbolic sign of hope for Palestinians, and also desperation that that because the situation on the ground is so bad that we feel we need to give a lifeline to the Palestinian people. So Israel could have avoided this if it had had a rational, peace-oriented, solution-oriented two-state solution. But Netanyahu keeps ruling out any Palestinian.
Well, I think the...
just one second, Louise. Larissa's muttering there about symbolism. Like, what's wrong with
symbolism? I'm sick of listening to symbolism. Symbolism is used. Look, let's just take, for example, we'll accept that the Irish position on this is a noble one. I'm just going to accept that for the sake of the conversation we're having here, and that it's sincere and all the rest of it. But time and again, we're hearing always now, oh, this is be good for symbolism. It's the symbolism on it. Like, symbolism, it is no real practical help to anyone. What does symbolism actually do? It literally, by its very definition, is just a sign of something. Is it your... I wonder, is it the new way of... is it the new word for kind of virtue signalling or political virtue signalling? Symbolism, to me, what we're symbolising here is that we're moving back from our neutrality, or certainly we're taking a very strong position.
Well, we are militarily neutral. Yeah, we take positions on things around
the world. I understand the difference, but the symbolism to me would be that's what the world would see the symbolism as. That's how I'm reading it anyway. But I'm just... Politically, I'm sick of hearing symbolism. It was used in the referendums as well. Oh, what will this? What change will this have? Oh, it'll be all about symbolism. But symbolism, I'm not sure if the risk benefit of symbolism. Okay. I wonder, is it worth it?
But of course, it's not just symbolism. Because if it was just symbolism, the Israeli government wouldn't have reacted the way they did.
It's putting
our limited negotiating ammunition in support of progress towards a two-state solution at a time when the Netanyahu government is making that more and more difficult by encouraging settlers to take over more and more land in Palestinian territory that doesn't belong to them.
So my question then, Bobby, is that, okay, notwithstanding our own limited contribution to this and everything, we're now at a situation where, like, Israel is way out of whack with, you know, what everybody is trying to say to them. America is maybe hasn't fully kind of damned them yet, but still the noises from there have becoming more and more disapproving. Is there... Does Netanyahu care anymore at this point? I mean, when the Americans did kind of, threaten to withdraw weapons in terms of Rafah, he says, we'll fight with our fingernails. Does he care anymore about what anyone thinks?
I think it's very sad because, you know, a two-state solution means that Israel has every right to exist in full security. But this is being brought on by the Netanyahu government. And when you say, does he care? He cares about one thing, and most international commentators say this. He cares about staying in power. And if the war ends, then there will be an election and he will lose. So it's partly to preserve his own political future that he's carrying on like this.
And we even saw him kind of disregard an offer of Saudi links as well in the last week, didn't he? Which is something that he would have probably given
because
his
he would have
fingernails
had to reach
for
the principle
at one
of a two-state solution, which is the only alternative. It's a difficult one. It's going to be hard to achieve. But if there isn't to be permanent bloodshed and destruction and suffering, there has to be a two-state solution. And Netanyahu is not only opposed to it in theory, but he is allowing further expansion of Jewish settlements in land that doesn't belong to them in order to make it impossible.
I think that's what is important in this conversation. And Taoiseach said it during the week, and he said, you know, Ireland wasn't represented by the IRA during the Troubles. The Palestinian people, Hamas is not representative of all of them. Netanyahu is certainly not representative of all the Israeli people. There is people, of course, who support him, but there's a lot of Israelis who absolutely abhor and detest what he is doing.
The vast majority want him out.
The vast majority want him out. So, I mean, when we're having this conversation about, you know, the likelihood of a two-state solution, it kind of appears that Netanyahu is the only person getting in the way of that. And that's why I think that what the Irish government did this week was a lot more than symbolism, because, I mean, this... please God, will end. Netanyahu, please God, won't be in power forever. And what's the kind of the path forward? And, you know, I think Hamas, it's unfortunate that they're in power. I don't think anyone would look at Palestine and go, that's who we want there. But at least, you know, Ireland is supporting a pathway forward. And I think that's important. And I think it's important to know there's a pathway forward, and that these people who are doing abhorrent things don't represent the vast majority of people.
Let's move closer to home. Oisin, you picked Alison O'Connor, who is has been thinking a lot about the timing of an election in recent months, lays out a thesis today in the Sunday Times. And she's saying, Harris bouncing polls could be springboard to an early election.
Yeah, she cycles through the multiple variables at play here, which includes the result of the European and local elections. It includes who goes to Europe. Is it Micheál Martin or Michael McGrath? When the budget is, one of the key things is if you're going to have a general election in November, you probably need to bring the budget forward so you can have a finance bill before you go to the polls, because we actually have a system of pretty good governance, as in even in the collapse in 2011, they waited until they had the Finance Act through with opposition support before they went to the country. So you can't just go to the polls overnight after a budget. You have to have the Finance Act. But certainly during the week too, I've been hearing the same, that despite what Harris said when he was elected, that the odds
I saw him say it again very clearly on, I think, to David McCullough on the 6-1 the other night, that he's going
I think I saw an announcement that said yes, but he has to say that, because if he says anything else, well, then we all know it's going to be sooner. So he has to keep saying that until he says the opposite. A bit like, you know, Rishi Sunak said it'll be the second half of the year, and now it's the 4th of July. So I think the key thing will be the date of the budget. Alison's article says that they don't have to tell us when they issue the summer economic statement. I heard Pat Leahy somewhere during the week saying they did have to tell us when they
they don't, Louise, no.
No, they don't. They haven't always. Sometimes they will tell you. Oftentimes, I think last year they said we'll have the budget on the 7th of October. I think the year before that, I think they gave a date in October, and then it was brought forward to, I want to say, it was the 27th of September. Yeah. So, I mean, they don't have to tell us. But
one tiny straw in the wind is that, and it's mentioned in the papers today, tomorrow the National Economic Dialogue, the annual sort of bun fight where the ministers meet all the stakeholders, including, I'll be there for the environmental groups tomorrow. That's come forward about 3 weeks this year. Now, it probably could be the European elections, but it may be allowing them to have the preparation
for the pickings. Right.
If not the actual date.
Against that background, there's a poll, Louise, in the Business Post today. And obviously, we don't place too much store in individual polls, but there are trends in the polls. So would you want to give us the results first, as say to the parties as they stand?
Yeah, definite trends in this. And just to point out, this was a Business Post Red Sea poll done online with 1,021 people between Friday the 17th and Wednesday the 22nd of May, with the margin of error of plus or minus 3%, before you give out to me for not saying it, Brendan. So really interesting poll, actually. So Sinn Féin are 23%. That's down 4, which is it's a good chunk for a party like Sinn Féin to be coming down, and it's not the first time they've fallen, but we'll get into that more. Fine Gael up 22, that's up 2 points. Fianna Fáil are 15%, up 1 point. Independents, who had been climbing quite a bit in the polls, they're at 19%, which is no change. The Sock Dems are at 5%, that's down 1 point. Labour are at 4%, up 1 point. People Before Profit Solidarity are at 3, that's up 1. And Ain't Two are also 3%, and that is down 1. So, I mean, quite an interesting poll.
And you gave us the Greens there, did you?
Oh,
4 plus 1.
I didn't, but there you go. Yeah. Sorry, Eamon Ryan. But yeah, no, it's quite an interesting poll. And I think the most amazing part of it is that Fine Gael have gone up quite a bit. So they've gone up 4 points since Harris took over from Leo Varadkar.
In this series of polls.
Of course, there's other polls, but in the Business Post, they've gone up 4%. And Sinn Féin have gone down quite a bit, and particularly among their young voters, which I found quite interesting, because oftentimes when you talk about Sinn Féin, you have seen this move to talk about the housing crisis, to kind of really hone in on those younger portion of voters. And they have, their younger vote is now down at 27%, which is down from 34% in April, which is, I mean, it's a 7-point decline. It's a huge decline, really.
Yeah,
and also their working class.
Yes.
Yeah, their working class vote. And I think this is really interesting, specifically, I guess, coming up to the local and European elections. And as Oisín has just unfortunately laid out, potentially a general election in the autumn or winter time, their working class vote is down by 14% between October and May. And I think a lot of that is being attributed to their kind of stance on immigration, that flip-flop back and forth on immigration, and that these working class communities, where oftentimes, I think it's fair to say, the international protection seeker accommodation is going into, that's kind of being attributed to the rise in support for independence as well. But I think for so long, Sinn Féin tried to be this party of change, and this party of change for everyone. And it seemed to be that they were trying to catch everyone in this wave of change, and as you get closer to elections, and I think as people find out where they actually stand on things, it seems to be working in the opposite way, where you have seen a very sharp decline of support for Sinn Féin, and it's not going to be welcome there's, 2 weeks out from elections.
There's one nugget in Daniel Murray's analysis which shows that says that previous in previous polls Sinn Féin supporters were the ones who were most likely to put immigration as their top issue, and now they're the least likely. And that would suggest that those who want tougher immigration policies are migrating from Sinn Féin to the independents.
Okay.
And those who want more liberal ones are migrating from Sinn Féin to the social democratic parties, i.e. Labour, Soc Dems and Greens, who are all up in this poll. Well, sorry, Soc Dems aren't. But there's a, so I think they're losing on both sides.
Yeah, but they were on the side of the government for too long on too many issues. And they weren't on the side of what I would call maybe traditional Sinn Féin values, things like what we would have looked at years ago. You know, I always say this because I come from a Sinn Féin family, although I'm not any party myself, honestly, and I'm very critical of Sinn Féin. But as a person who should be a traditional Sinn Féin voter, I can tell you why I would be disinclined to vote for them at the moment. And that would be because they're too much on the side of the government all the time. They're on the side of the government with the referendum. They didn't stand up against hate speech. They don't speak. They don't have the courage to speak on issues that I would think that normal, ordinary working class people want to hear said in a nice, compassionate manner, not in, you know.
No, they're speaking out on housing, they're speaking out on health. And I mean, this thing, Bobby, about Sinn Féin flip-flopping on migration, has everybody not, all parties have radically changed the tone of their policies and their output.
Yeah, sorry, Sinn Féin voters would have expected that. For me, it's an issue of equality, is if you treat everybody the same and make sure there's room for everybody in society. And I would think that that's another reason why Sinn Féin voters are moving away.
Yeah, could I say, I mean, I'm not a natural Sinn Féin supporter, but I think we're fortunate to have a main opposition party that doesn't make an issue over migration. Most countries have a right-wing radical party, and it's something that is very good. The one thing I picked out from this poll, and it's a small thing because it's a concern of mine, is what the priorities are for electors in relation to the European Parliament elections. Mm-hmm. Because the issues that they picked are nothing to do with Europe. Yeah. Cost of living, health services, where the EU has very few competences, and climate change, where Europe has a very big role, is very low down in the priorities. And so I know you don't want it on this programme to talk about individual candidates or parties, and I won't, but I do think it's important that people understand what the elections are about, what areas that Europe actually has competence in, and what type of people can contribute. Because individual MEPs can contribute enormously if they have expertise, if they have the competence to become rapporteur in particular subjects, if they have the knowledge of the subjects, and of course in political groups. I mean the independent support for European elections at the moment is at 21%, and that's fine, and I'm sure they can make a contribution. But of course, political groups at the European level play a big role as well. So I think it's quite striking how people's concerns for Europe are really national concerns that can't be affected by the people
they elect.
Could
I make one point? There was a takeaway. There's one really important takeaway I thought from that poll was that rich people, to put it simply, are more likely to vote for independence now. A quarter, 25%, and that's up from 15% in the last poll. And the less well-off have dropped support for independence, which I think is a very curious finding. It's gone from 23% down to 13%. Okay, so I don't know why that is.
Yeah, in one poll and with margins of errors and everything else.
Yeah.
Oisín, did you want to say something?
It is worth saying that MEPs, Irish MEPs in this parliament, have actually played a significant role in quite a lot of legislation.
Okay, as a group. Yeah. As a group, Oisín.
Yes, as a group. But it's Bobby's point that MEPs can contribute a lot at European level to European legislation that affects our lives. And they did in the last Parliament.
Well, something like 70% of legislation that is transposed here is European election. And it's funny when, you know, I've been out canvassing with most of the big parties now, with the exception of Sinn Féin. So I'm not really sure how they're getting on the doors. Hopefully I will get out with them at some stage if anyone's listening. But I've been out with the other big parties, and it is, you know, when the MEP candidates are going to the door, it is housing, it is health, it is cost of living. The immigration thing, it's coming up sometimes, but not very often. So I think it just goes to show that stuff like housing is really, really a big issue.
Immigration
and it's going
to
stay
immigration,
the big issue.
Maybe. People have
to leave. Immigration rather than immigration. People leaving because, exactly, people leaving, their daughters leaving, their sons leaving because they can't afford to rent, they can't afford to buy. So I think it just goes to show oftentimes we get so transfixed on things like immigration that are all over the newspapers, all over the media, but the issues aren't coming up as much on the doors as you might expect them
to. Are you saying you've asked about Sinn Féin and they haven't said yes?
We're organising.
You know what?
It.
We'll take that conversation offline. We'll get transfixed with immigration in a minute, but first we'll take a break. Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlan, Bobby McDonough, and Larissa Nolan staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. Our panel's still here. Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlan, Bobby McDonough, and Larissa Nolan. Oisin, that story on the front of the Sunday Independent, Maeve Sheehan was out with Gardaí doing checks, not at the border.
Yes.
We should say. The bus is like a Schrodinger's cat. It is in a liminal space that is not the border.
The headline says checks at border, but as yeah. The article says, not near the border. But this is an interesting development based, given what we've discussed in this programme before about the UK saying no hard border and not wanting us to return anybody, that the Garda, the National Immigration Bureau and the PSNI have been together cooperating on what are called here 3 days of action on the road from Belfast to Dublin, during which 50 people were stopped without valid documents from entering the country. And it talks about in the inside pages, Maeve Sheehan, who spent a day with them this week, talks about them being taken off the bus and being put into holding cells on the side of the road in a big police van, and then being brought straight to the port and being accompanied from Dublin to Holyhead by Irish police guard.
And a notification to the
sent
UK,
to the UK.
That they're
yes.
coming.
So yeah. It all appears that there's, despite what Rishi Sunak was saying, that on the ground there has been, ongoing cooperation. I think it said that there was 11 days of action last year, and now there's been 12 this year already. Now, it does okay. strike me that the word days of action and it being weekly means this is not really border enforcement. It is signalling that we're not going to have
symbolism. Would we say that?
Well, you might be talking. You might say that, Brendan. I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay.
Just to be clear, though, for the people affected directly, she talks about the very disappointed and, you know, sort of discombobulated looking immigrant who is being taken and put on into the holding cell and being brought to the, I think some of them are from Afghanistan and elsewhere. There was one families from Jordan. So, you know, for those who are involved, it's far from symbolic. It's a very substantial return. And it's not clear to me what happens when they get back to the UK. That's not touched on here. And you have to wonder, because it comes up, the issue of racial profiling. How do you get on those buses coming from, and I don't think Maeve Sheehan was on the bus, how do you get on the bus coming from Belfast to Dundalk and decide who to ask?
Now, there seems to be a suggestion they go down the bus talking to people. So we just to say there is no suggestion in there that they are picking people.
And they say they're trained on this matter,
anything,
but they either have
yeah.
to ask everybody, which means that if I'm travelling in the bus as an Irish citizen with our open border between North and South, I have to be able to justify and explain that I'm Irish or that I have a right to be there, or else they have to try, or else if they don't like my accent or they feel I can't answer their questions, it just brings up a whole world of uncertainty, I think.
Bobby, you were looking at that as well.
Yeah, I think overall in migration, we have to have a balanced approach. I think we should be as generous as possible towards Ukrainian refugees and asylum seekers, and we should meet our international political and legal responsibilities. But at the same time, there have to be some limits in terms of not getting too far out of step with our EU partners and to counter asylum shopping. In this particular case...
So, Oisin is saying there it's very unfortunate for those people, men we'll assume, right, because they probably are on the bus and everything. But is that what a fair... rules-based system, the fair rules-based system we talk about, is going to look like?
Well,
it's not pretty, is it?
There's going to be a tough side to having a balanced approach. If you don't have any sort of controls and checks and people who are asylum shopping aren't sent back, it isn't just those people who will come in, but there'll be more and more people coming in through those channels. So instinctively, we would all like to be as generous as possible, and I would be. But it doesn't seem to me unreasonable to have checks in this particular case. And it's a two-way process, because there will also be people arriving here who will want to go to the UK. And that will be especially the case when Sunak loses the next election and when Starmer has said that he'll abolish the Rwanda policy. There will be people arriving here who will want to have family reunions. You also have the Northern Ireland Court ruling that the Rwanda policy doesn't even now apply in Northern Ireland. So you could have people moving across the border. So it's understandable that the authorities, North and South, are cooperating on these things.
So from this, you do think that despite all that kind of war of words a couple of weeks ago, and which a lot of people said was kind of election-y posturing and everything, on the ground, actually, quietly, there is cooperation going on among the mechanisms.
Well, I know it because of the article. I mean, yeah. Oisin has quoted the number of joint operations that there have been between the PSNI and the Gardaí on this. So, I mean, there's a degree of irrationality in Downing Street, as we know. I mean, a degree of almost childishness when somebody on behalf of Sunak said Ireland could join the UK-Rwanda policy if we wanted to, and saying Ireland should avoid checks on the border. I mean, that's childish. That's trying to replay the Brexit thing. And I think it's partly because a lot of the people who work in Downing Street are so-called spads. They're people who come straight from university into politics. They think they're clever, but they don't have any real experience of the real world.
OK, Larissa, you picked Colin Murphy's piece, Ireland Isn't Full, But We Lack Capacity for Common Sense. And he's not talking in the new meaning of the word common sense, which means like quasi-far right or something at this stage, depending on who you talk to. He's saying actual old-fashioned common sense.
Yeah, and actually, the reason I love this piece by Colin is that it is what we were talking about earlier on. It's more about emigration than it is about immigration. And he's, I suppose, tying up, our history with the debate that we're having now. But there was just, I just wanted to pick it out because he came across a beautiful song by a writer called Peter Jones, who's talking about a child that left, or a young man who left Ireland in the 1800s, and his dad had to get the local schoolmaster to write letters to him, and eventually those letters, they go on over the years, and eventually the dad dies and someone writes and tells him that the dad has died. So it's just about
it's beautiful,
the way he's explained it is lovely. But I
and
suppose
the father, doesn't the father is saying to me, maybe you'll come back for a visit sometime, I might see you, but never saw him again.
Yeah. So I mean, that's, he's just tying that in, and I suppose
Kilkelly Ireland is the name of that song.
I should name it. It's Kilkelly Ireland, yeah, and it's one worth looking into. But I suppose what he is, what Colin is saying here is, you know, is that the way that we were, maybe we have to look back on how we were making our own way in the world. Now, a lot of people will say that those kind of comparisons aren't correct, because I think a lot of the time the immigration issue can come back to, are we paying these people, or are they working here? Obviously, the Irish, when we went off, we worked like mad and built America and all the rest, blah, blah, blah. So I think sometimes that they can be, those kind of comparisons can be not direct, but at the same time, what he's saying is these are people who leave their countries, they're going somewhere else, and I do think that there is merit in that connection that he has made here in this piece in Sunday Independent.
Oisin,
just you mentioned, are we paying them or are they working? There's an interesting piece on the front, on the business section of the Sunday Times, which is basically about how dependent the economy is on foreign workers, and that we're basically at full employment, and the number of those employed among Irish citizens has only gone up by less than 1%, but the number of those employed who are non-Irish citizens has gone up almost 8%. So it's just showing you we are depending on migrants.
No, make no mistake. I'm actually very, very strong supporter of immigration personally. But what I'm saying is, we know a lot of them are, of course, Irish people love the working person who comes in here. What I'm saying is, maybe the question with immigration is the people who aren't working.
There's a broader story here, isn't there, which doesn't kind of get front page headlines, but which is that I think the reproduction rate in Ireland is currently 1.5%, right? I think the replacement rate, nothing to do with the great replacement, the replacement rate for a population is 2.1%. All over Europe, it's lower than that. Italy, they've been basically paying people tax incentives and everything to have children. Europe, I think, is the oldest population in the world. It's the only population that's declining. It's the only population where the working age is declining.
I think the Chinese population is declining, and even the Indian population isn't renewing itself. It's only in Africa that population is growing.
This kind of comes back to this debate we were having, if you think back, probably the last year, 2 years, 3 years since the last general election, about the idea of the pension age and what age you set the pension age at, because there's a population, we have an ageing population with very few workers coming in to replace them. So you have this whole idea of, well, are we going to actually be able to afford to pay the pensions of people who are retiring? So, I mean, there's that part of it as well. You've more people paying into the PRSI system. And I mean, there is government moves to cut back on the amount of people who are working, and also asylum seekers who are working and also claiming allowances, and that's going to be means tested very soon. But I mean, I think people are coming here, they can work after 5 or 6 months. There's actually been suggestions, could you let them work sooner, because men are coming here wanting to work.
The pension age to stay at 65, we need the foreign workers to come and pay PRSI so we can retire at 65.
Okay, so we appeal to people's sense of selfishness about it, maybe. Okay. Who's going to kick us off on 2FM and RT and related matters? Louise, Sunday Times, radio hosts air grievances over RTE.
Yeah, this is a really way of interesting way of doing it here from Erin McCaffrey and Ellen Convery. And what they did was they actually spoke to a number of former RTE broadcasters, and they kicked off with Gareth O'Callaghan, who's a former 2FM presenter, and they were talking to him in the context of a mass exodus we know of 2FM presenters. We had Ciarán Garrahy from The Breakfast Show announcing a couple of weeks ago that she was going to pursue other projects. We had the two Johnnies this week or last week, and then Jennifer Zambarelli in more recent days as well, announcing that they were all leaving the station. And I guess this kind of caused this chaos, I guess you can call it, in 2FM, of who's going to replace these people, and the impact that new rules about declaring external interests and declaring side work as influencers perhaps is having on staff. But I thought Gareth O'Callaghan made a really interesting point that I agree with, to be honest. He was saying that in the 80s and 90s, you had this radio station where people who worked there were committed to the brand. And what's happening now is that we're in an age of influencers and there's no longer the same amount of loyalty. And I mean, I guess I would look at this from a case of, you know, I study journalism. I have a lot of friends in the media, some who made it, some who haven't, some who are still trying to break into it. And they see these people coming into 2FM. And it's no slight, by the way, against anyone that's working in 2FM. I don't listen to 2FM to know if they're good, bad, whatever, but you have seen this trend, I guess, over the last couple of years of people with big names. Sometimes they do have broadcasting experience, sometimes they don't have broadcasting experience, being brought in to host these shows. And I know that really annoys people, both who are working their asses off, to be perfectly honest, in places like 2FM trying to get a break, and they can't get a break because these shows are being occupied by the influencers, the big names who don't have that same level of experience.
Would it be a little bit of a slight though, Louise, against people who didn't go to university?
No, but I more so mean the people who, you know, are successful on social media, who have never had broadcasting experience, who just because
yeah, but
they
I suppose
have a
nobody
couple of
has broadcasting
thousand.
Experience
the,
until they
and the two
get
Johnnies
broadcasting
themselves,
experience.
They did a podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've no issue with the two Johnnies. That's actually not who I'm talking about, to be perfectly honest. But I mean, everyone has to start somewhere. And there's people who are slaving away for years and years and years. Regardless, some have university degrees, some don't. Some have literally started
community
radio. I tried to work their way up.
Brendan, I'm not a listener to 2FM, but if everybody else walks out, I'm prepared to become a presenter. I have no broadcasting experience, but I'm available.
Okay. You'll spin a few discs, will you, Bobby? Hello, pop pickers.
Do you not think we should just let these people make the money? Because is that not just the answer to it? I mean, that's the question Sarah McGuinness is asking in the Business Post today. These people can make $500,000 a year, okay, maybe, you know, after tax, XYZ. But I mean, the thing is, if you're not going to be paid enough, I think that the taxpayer doesn't care once we're not paying it. Let them go off and make whatever money they
want elsewhere. Well, I think OTE has been through a very difficult period with inadequate financial controls and overindulgence of talent, and they've tried to introduce transparency and registers.
Talent in what way? One presenter was at the centre of this, and it wasn't about the two Johnnies or anyone else. Yeah. It was about corporate governance in this organisation. It wasn't presenters.
No, but one of the things that was introduced was a register. And I think it would be implausible to back away from that.
It's very, very tight, the register of interests. And I think what's happening here is we're suffering from the politics of the last scandal. So in the rush to try to shut down the issues last summer around how RTE had handled payments to Ryan Tuberty, they brought in all these regulations without thinking about what the modern marketplace means for another station on campus. And I think because as we can see, the two Johnnies were saying basically it isn't even that, it's that we can't do all of these things and now we need to choose which to do. I think, you know, if RTE wants to stay relevant to young people, they need people who are big on TikTok and big on social media. And I think they may have shot themselves in the foot by not accommodating these influencers last year.
I think, in fairness, two Johnnies were here yesterday and it was nothing to do with influencers. For them, they were just, as you said, they have lots of pots on the boil, and it was time.
But
that's a sign that they need
to make it attractive for people, and actually they need to probably include the social media in their
RTE should be like working in 2FM, working in RTE, that should be a big deal to people. That should mean something to people. It shouldn't be seen. I was having this conversation with someone during the week. Fine, go make your money influencing. 2FM shouldn't be seen as your side job. 2FM should be seen as your main
unless
job.
Unless you're going
it's
to pay a
Tubridy
style salary. Yeah. That's just not the way.
But there are lots of people who would bite the hand off
exactly.
you to get a
yeah,
gig.
Yeah, it shouldn't be seen as
2FM.
A side
job. Okay.
It should be seen as a very important job. And oftentimes I would fear that it's not seen as people's main jobs. Influencing is seen as people's main jobs. And RTE 2FM is just your side job. And I don't think that should be the case.
Larissa, I just want to get in housing. It is up there in people's concerns. Brenda Power is writing about housing referendum is a waste of time and cash.
Yeah. Now, you would think, wouldn't you, being me banging the housing drum for the last 10 years, you would think that I would support a referendum on housing. I'm not actually sure that I do. I'm very conflicted about this because I think it's been the social ill of our generation and has destroyed lives up and down the country. And something needs to change fast, which the Housing Commission report evidently said. But I wonder about, and the one thing that the Commission did kind of balk at or fudge away from was the idea of a referendum, which is kind of idealistically, and it's a noble idea, again, it's but it's I'm not sure that it would ultimately help. And Brenda explains why, in that it would have the effect of it would be would literally be the case where people wouldn't be housed because the government can't magic up a house at a certain time, maybe, or for whatever reason. And then that just goes into the courts, and you're looking at all that money, the cost of the referendum for starters. I can't remember, Louise, you probably remember much the last one cost, but it's mad money. So you have that cost, and then you have the cost of the courts court cases that will come up as a result of it. I think it would be defeatist to say we need a referendum on housing. I think we just need to make the government do it. Instead of saying, we need a referendum on housing, this should be a natural right in life. And I think perhaps in other parts of the Constitution it states that a roof over your head, a roof over your head for children particularly, I'm not sure that we actually need a referendum on it. I don't think that will necessarily change anything that the government is doing.
Okay.
There's other things we need to do, but a referendum, not so sure.
Okay, do you mind if I ask you about your circumstances? Because you've talked to us here before about being a renter and very little prospect of getting a house.
Yeah.
You got a house, but you got it, I think part of what you think is that the behaviour of the people around you, the people who sold you the house and everything, was kind of conscience driven?
Yeah, maybe like I was saying, kind of ethical selling almost or something like that. A lot of people, I was 10 years trying to get a house. I think the last thing I said to you, Brendan, in the show was, you asked me, do you think I'd ever buy one? And I said, I can't see that happening in my future. But a couple of things came together. I was supported by people around me in relation to the big problem for a lot of people who are renting at high rates is getting a deposit together. So that was really important to me, that I was financially aided there. I'm able to pay all that money back and so on and so forth. But the major thing was that the wonderful woman who sold me my house in the inner city, it's only a small little house, but I'm delighted to have it. I feel like it's a massive achievement and a major privilege, is that she didn't look at me and say, oh, I can sell this house for that. She said, what can you give me? Mm. And I was able to offer her what I could offer her. And because she wanted a family in that home, she sold it to me for that price. Now, she could have been greedy and, you know, added on X, Y, Z on top of it. But
presumably it would have been worth more yield wise or something to maybe a fund or whatever.
Well, I mean,
but she
said to me, will you be living here? You won't change it. You won't flip it. You won't Airbnb it. And I said, absolutely not. This is me here forever, the house for my son.
Interesting.
And she was willing to do that in order to have a family.
Because there can be a culture here of trying to squeeze the last drop out of every time we sell a house, get the most you can from everyone, which is understandable too, but that's a really interesting notion. Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlin, Bobby McDonagh and Larissa Nolan staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlin, Bobby McDonagh and Larissa Nolan are still with us. And now Oisin Coughlin is going to give us a brief dissertation on bees off the back of Valerie Hanley's piece in the Mail today. So I thought all these people who had beehives were good people, Oisin.
They think they are. And obviously bees are important, but this is actually I'd been becoming aware of this. This is basically that we're overwhelming our wild native bee species with these sort of megaplexes of beehives and the honeybees. So this is a guy called Paul Handrick, the bee guy, who has tens of thousands of followers worldwide with his advice. And basically he's saying go and get some native Irish flowers, untreated with chemicals, and plant them. And that's the best thing you can do for bees. Don't go and get yourself a hive and become a beekeeper, an amateur beekeeper, because actually you're kind of, it's like dumping on the market.
Big bee is taking over.
Okay. So better
and
to
listen,
plant some flowers.
Am I right in thinking, is this true? You know, there's this notion that if the bees die, that means it's curtains for all of us. Like,
well, it's certainly that there is a quote that's a misquote from Einstein that he said this. So I think that's fake news. But it is true that bees and other pollinators, it's also wasps and other things, of course, but wasps and bees are the poster boys for pollinators. So that we do, we rely on our food on the work they do. And if those populations crash and they have been under severe pressure, well, then it is a spanner in the works of our supply chain of food. Yes, absolutely.
So there's a little suggestion he makes, as you say, that and anyone could do this. He says even people with apartments with a box in the balcony or anything, you go and you look for
Irish native wildflowers untreated with the chemicals. So you'd have to ask that when you go into the shop. But if you get that and you put them anywhere, you put them in a pot or in your garden. And we are seeing, I mean, it is amazing how things can change so quickly. If you look around the streets, the streets of Dublin in particular, and maybe elsewhere, parks and roundabouts have now been let go kind of half wild. And it is, that's how we...
It's lovely. It's very appealing to the kind of soul or something, isn't it? Yes. Like, it's, there's something about that wildness that...
And you'll know that the native
resonates
wild
with
honeybees
us,
and other pollinators are having a good time.
Okay, there's a few things I want to get through now. Louise, Ireland has a sunbed salon for every day of the year, according to the Sunday Indo, and this is not good.
No, as someone who like applies layers of SPF every day, this absolutely blew my mind. So, and I actually drove past a sunbed shop yesterday and two girls walked out of it, and I thought that sunbeds, and this article confirmed it, were meant to be banned for under 18s, and these two young ones were definitely under 18. But it talked about how many tanning salons or sunbed salons are in Ireland. Like you said, 365. Now that is down about 40% since 2015, when there were over 600, but it's still a huge amount. And in a country where there's 11,000 cases of skin cancer every year, it's the most common form of cancer. And there's a stat in this article that if you use sunbeds for the first time before you're 35, you have an increased risk of melanoma. That increases by up to 75%. So it's absolutely wild. And I kind of just would have thought, with the knowledge that we have now, compared to when we did years and years ago, the knowledge that we have now of how dangerous these things are. I mean, I won't even go get my nails done without putting a layer of SPF on my hands. So like, the fact that people are actually just going and lying in this. And I actually Googled when I drove
past.
Well,
you put SPF in your hands for the light that they do
when I go to get my
under.
Nails done.
Yeah. Is that a UV light or something?
It's an LED light, but I still have it in my head that I'm very conscious about these things. I would have a history of melanoma in my own family, so it's kind of embedded into myself and my brother by my mother that you have to be using your SPF. So I'm very conscious of these things anyway. But it kind of just blows my mind given how much we know, and there seems to be huge amounts of these popping up. Like, there's a huge big one after opening in a town local to me.
Very good.
It's beside a gym, and you would worry about the impact.
Like the candidates, we don't want to single out anyone tanning.
I wasn't going to say it.
So look, the message is, as much as we give out about the young ones whacking on the mahogany out of the bottle,
that's the safest form of tanning, which is why you will always find me, not today, I'm very pale, but you will always find me with a layer of fake tan on, because it's the safest form of tanning.
On top of your SPF.
On top of my SPF. My SPF on top of it.
Bobby, we should briefly allude to the snap general election in the UK. You picked a piece here, Toby Helm in The Observer. The campaign started badly, but things could get worse. It hasn't been a good read, has it?
It's a good read because he starts off with the fact that Rishi Sunak gave his press conference in the rain with Labour music blaring in the background. Then he had a press conference in Northern Ireland near the Titanic headquarters. He went to Wales and asked the crowd whether they were looking forward to Euro 2024 football, even though Wales were knocked out. And it does seem as if the Tories have been caught more off guard than Labour have by this. So the article says that there's a negative momentum, and it's very difficult to reverse a negative momentum. But I think just say the outcome...
There's the so-called chicken run as well, of about a quarter or so.
Yeah, exactly. You have many people like Andrea Leadsom, Michael Gove, John Redwood, and on top of that, there will probably be well-known people who lose their sights on,
come
seats
here,
on the night.
Have they had enough? Has Rishi Sunak had enough? Is he thinking, I want to get back to my multi-billionaire lifestyle, like, so I'm not even going to try here.
Look, people are speculating, but who knows? And my view is that human motivation is mixed. I might have said that on the programme before, but nobody does anything in life for only one reason. So there's a combination of reasons, and one of the reasons maybe that is fed up. But I think the outcome is very important for Ireland, because we could get back to proper co-guarantorship on Northern Ireland. We could get better British relations with Europe, which would be very good for us. And I think the idea of Brexit as a rallying ideal is now dead. So for many reasons, the almost inevitable Starmer victory is going to be good for Ireland.
And would you see better relations with the EU? I mean, I think they're improving anyway between the UK and the EU, aren't they? And Ukraine and stuff has helped all that. But would you see Starmer radically changing the relationship?
I think he will take certain steps quickly. I think Britain will rejoin the Erasmus student programme, for example, which is fairly simple. I think he will. He has already said he wants to negotiate a veterinary agreement, which would help the whole issue around the border in the Irish Sea. I think he will work more closely on the European Union on security issues. But I think
trade is dead.
Being elected on the basis of no single market, no customs union. So he's not going to move very quickly on that. But I think he hopes to be a two-term prime minister. And I think probably in the middle of the first term, he may start exploring those things. And Professor John Curtis, who's one of the most distinguished British political commentators and psephologist, he said he would expect another Brexit referendum before 2040. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
Okay, ending on a hopeful note there. And thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning. Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Oisin Coughlan, chief executive, Friends of the Earth Ireland. Bobby McDonough, former ambassador to the UK and the EU. And Larissa Nolan, features editor at the Reach Group of newspapers and websites. And look, if you got nothing else out of that hour, go and get a few. So we want untreated Irish wildflower seeds. Okay.